Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges.
Good afternoon. This is the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm joined in a conference call today by two independent filmmakers whose work is premiering at the 2015 Tribeca Film Festival, along with Peter Hutchinson. They are directors and producers of Requiem for the American Dream. If you hear hints of Noam Chomsky in there, well, that's because there is. I'm talking to Kelly Nikes and Jared P. Scott. Kelly, how are you?
Good. Thank you for having us, Marcello. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure, too. And you, Jared?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much, for having me.
Okay. And Jared has already told me he hails from Brooklyn. How about you, Kelly?
Brooklyn as well. I'm in Cambridge at the moment, but I would call myself a proud Brooklynite as well.
All right. Okay. Well, I used to be across the river in Manhattan. So we are talking about this feature-length documentary, Requiem for the American Dream, and your only cast member is Noam Chomsky. And the troubling thing is that it's about something we all suspect, but I imagine your documentary really delivers the proof, and that is that there really are two Americas. Kelly, can you start us off with that?
I think that you're right on target, Marcello. The idea of inequality in America, the idea of a wealth gap between the very wealthy and the rest of America, the ever-shrinking middle class, the stagnation of wages, these are all things that are now part of the popular conversation, kind of the dialogue that we're all rather familiar with, that we hear in different places, that we've seen on The Daily Show, or that we've seen in newscasts, or we've seen on podcasts. But what I think is so valuable about how it is that Noam Chomsky unpacks this and why we were so fortunate to be able to do so in its feature-length film is that he, through both personal experience and also through his encyclopedic knowledge, is able to take a long-lens perspective on this inequality. And he's able to put it into a historical context that allows you to understand it not just as an issue of the moment, but something in the entire narrative of the American democratic experiment. And I think why that's helpful is, first of all, it informs you to a greater degree about what the true causes are of the circumstances that we're facing.
Yes.
The fact that this inequality didn't spring from the financial crisis, or didn't come about from the hysteria of the stock market at the end of the 20th century, but the fact that this, as he tells it, was a very clear reaction to the civilizing and democratizing effects of the 60s. And once you start looking at this through the lens of principles that can be unpacked and understood, I think that it does a great deal to actually counteract that despair that you're referring to, the fact that this does not need to be seen as end time, but that, yes, we have a very significant democratic problem right now. You have an aristocracy in a certain sense that has been controlling America, and legislation is architected to ensure that that control stays. There are opportunities to address that, and I think that that's what's really, for us, that is what, despite the fact that there are red flags about which to be concerned,
yes.
That there still ultimately is hope in the democratic experiment that we are all part of and that we all have ownership of.
You know, I'm glad to hear you mention the word hope because, as we were discussing before we went on air, Noam Chomsky, I'm familiar with him and his work and failed states and others. And what has there have been two things that, many things that have impressed me about him. He's troubling because he really, really makes us think beyond the superficial. And as you say, this long lens. This is not, as I often write myself, this is not something that just happened all of a sudden with Bush Cheney. If anything, not symptoms, they are the result of what has been happening all along, and it continues to happen. It's a bipartisan issue, if you will, and it certainly is a challenge to Americans who believe there is hope to pay attention and to do something about it. Jared, how does it feel to be able to bring this cold water in our face to the Tribeca Film Festival?
Sure. Well, I mean, we've talked about this a lot. I mean, the reason why Peter Kelly and I wanted to come to Tribeca, or why we wanted to choose New York, is that, you know, this is the financial capital of the world.
Yes.
And, you know, this conversation is had a lot. I mean, you know, when we talk about the, you know, the 1% or inequality, oftentimes we think about New York.
Yes.
I think that we are, and just to clarify earlier, although I do reside in Brooklyn, I'm originally from, I hail from Ohio, Ohio. So I have Midwestern roots. And
uh-huh.
So, you know, like, you know, Kelly and I, like many people, have come here and, you know, we have our own struggles in the creative world, but you start to see inequality, I think, in a, it's kind of front and center
yes.
sometimes in New York. And, you know, whether it's the building that I can see out my window now that is taller than the Empire State Building, that's kind of basically a residency for oligarchs and
yes.
Or, you know, you see this. And so we wanted to bring this film, we wanted to bring this story to New York.
Uh-huh.
And although we discuss inequality, I think that it's important to understand that this film is quite different. You know, we walk through these principles
yes.
of the concentration of wealth and power. And, you know, we've been able to carefully go through multiple interviews with Noam Chomsky, with Professor Chomsky, over
uh-huh.
a number of years.
Uh-huh.
And I think that right now this message is as important and as relevant and as in your face as it's ever been. And so this city makes perfect sense for that. And, you know, I think that the New York crowd will find that this resonates and hits home.
Yes.
And then that, you know, that this message is one that that will resonate throughout the festival.
I wonder, Kelly, can you make any connection, and maybe this is arbitrary, maybe not, but it just occurred to me as I was listening to Jared, a connection between, draw a line, if you will, from 9/11 to Citizens United. Is that overstating?
Well, I'm glad that this isn't lost. Because I would have to think for a second about correlating that. Can you unpack for me a bit about what might be to be able to
Well, I'm actually going, because Jared mentioned the 10 principles, and I'm assuming of the concentration of wealth and power, and it just popped in my head, to be honest. There is so much trauma still about 9/11, and I'm not talking conspiracy, that's not what I'm after, but that the impact of that in every way, of course financially, but psychologically, and what the rippling effect on the public that I think allowed us to excuse things happening that changed dramatically. I think this, I've always felt, you know, this started at least with the Marshall Plan. It was a good idea, and then some guys with money said, hey, if we can make money rebuilding Europe, imagine how we can make money, you know, if we just take over everything. But from there to you, events like in Dallas, and then to 9/11, and I know I'm skipping over things, but to end up with something like Citizens United and have not as much of a public backlash. I know a lot of people talk about Citizens United and petitions online, and I myself have been a part of the grassroots lobbyists going to the Hill about it, etc. But when we look at it in terms of Requiem for the American Dream, is there a line to be drawn or to be learned from between those two events?
I think actually that what you touch on is the idea of threat.
Yes.
And I think that we have seen a fraying of the social fabric in America since what's known as the Golden Age, that age,
yes,
that era from 1946 until 1963,
yes,
which is a time where one of the only times in America where you saw the upper quintile, and Chomsky articulates it,
yes,
very, very thoughtfully and very digestibly in Requiem for the American Dream, where he talks about in that era that was based on manufacturing, that saw the opportunity, while there were still obviously significant social improvements that had to be made, some very important battles that took place around civil rights and equality between sexes in the 50s and the 60s.
Yes.
But there was an opportunity for one based largely on the availability of government-supported education,
mm-hmm,
through the Army GI Bill, through,
yes,
education being a fraction of its cost to what it is today.
Yes.
You saw real material opportunity, and that real material opportunity manifested itself as lower quintile in society, and this is statistically proven. The research is there, and Chomsky refers to it in the film. The lower quintile in society was doing as well as the upper quintile in society.
Yes.
Here's something that might shock you, and I'm certain, and I'm quietly confident that it will shock your listeners as well. But in that period, underneath a Republican president, in President Eisenhower,
yes,
you saw the upper tax rate on income never lower than 91%.
Yes, that's right.
Never lower than 91%, which means that it went up to 93%, which means that we as an American society, in an era that saw broad movement of different social income levels upward, in that era, we decided as a people, this is what we think is most important, and we will distribute our wealth accordingly.
Yes.
And you saw then America at the forefront of industry in terms of manufacturing and setting new standards for what it is that workers could gain and wages in relationship between those who are on the factory floor and those who are in the boardroom.
Yes.
And we made those decisions as a community, again, not without struggle and not without strife. But we have moved away from that. And there's a reason why we've moved away from that. It's not arbitrary, but it's as you rightly pointed out, it's for a very specific reason.
So yes.
When you see, for example, the Powell memorandum that Justice Powell, before he was nominated to the Supreme Court,
yes,
by Nixon, you saw him write the Powell memorandum and he describes what they then, to the Chamber of Commerce, what they then articulated as a broad attack on the American free enterprise system. And they said, we need to control this messaging better. We need to control the institutions of indoctrination better,
yes,
i.e. the churches and the schools, which are responsible, in their words, for the indoctrination of the young.
Yes.
And you see these steps take place where people become more insecure. Robert Greenspan even mentioned this when he was in front of the House on the unexpected worker insecurity that had led to the flatlining of wages,
yes,
and that was atypical in his, you know, very often difficult to decipher type of language that he would employ.
Mm.
So I think that what you're referring to is the fact that people feel, and this is what Chomsky speaks to so clearly and so lucidly, people feel like they just have less opportunity today. And
yes,
when you look at stagnating wages for the last 2.5 decades, when you look at what these unbelievable debt loans that people are taking on to be able to get education,
mm,
you can understand that there is a greater sense of fragility and insecurity when people are living,
yes,
from paycheck to paycheck, or when they're struggling to get health care.
Yes.
But that has become a real struggle. So I think that there's a stress and a pressure on the social fabric,
yes,
that is far greater today than we see in example, the Golden Age,
yes,
and I think that manifests itself in different, you know, in different ways that people are able to grab power, and I think Citizens United is a clear example of that.
Yes, I couldn't agree more, and I'm glad you you made the connection that it's the threat, it's the pressure, and it starts intentionally by programming education. You know, it's not an accident. We keep talking about infrastructure, but as I'm fond of saying, our infrastructure really is our children. And when we limit how they learn, what they learn, and where they learn, even that physical structure, I don't think that's an accident. It's an awful lot of money for all of the complaints of either party about what we can spend and austerity and coming back, you know, sequester and all that. America really has a great deal of money. The question is how it is distributed and by whom and when and where. And Jared, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that, well, first I wanted to just clarify, before when I was, I mentioned that building that I'm looking out the window, I was referring to 432 Park Avenue.
It's
become like the largest, you know, residential building in the Western Hemisphere.
Yes. Okay.
That's the one that, you know, you see and it's, I think when a place goes for anywhere between $17 million and $100 million. And so it's just a big monolithic structure that's kind of, just kind of encapsulates this idea of inequality, the idea that the rich have so much. And now you can even, you know, in our city, look down at the Empire State Building from your penthouse suite. That's an interesting visual to add to our iconic skyline.
Yes.
I think Kelly hit it on the head. I mean, you know, when we, you know, if you go back and you know, why we say Requiem for the American Dream is we look at this time in American history, right, where after World War II, we created the largest middle class in the world.
Yes.
The largest that we had ever seen. And you speak of infrastructure, and you're right. That's a time when same middle class was able to build the largest infrastructure project in our history, the highway system.
Yes.
You know, we had the best system for free public education. We expanded higher education. We had we had a strong safety net. As Kelly said, there was a strong sense of collective determinism. Now, all of that, you know, as Chomsky rightfully points out, there is some, you know, you have to look at these myths, and you know, it's definitely partly true that you could then, as a worker, go to Detroit, get a job at an auto plant, have two cars, have a home, send your kids to college. You know, there's other things that you have to look at in the picture too. You know, it's always like this idea of the American dream. There's always two sides to that coin.
Sure.
Like any ideal, like any myth. But there is some truth to that, and so I guess what we try to look at, you know, we mention that time period, but then we look over the last 30 years. By contrast, you see that there's been stagnation across the board for the American worker. That the rich have gotten richer, as you said, the distribution of wealth, you know, whether it's the tax rate that Kelly mentioned, which is now I think the highest is around 40% today, and of course with the taxes on dividends and corporate taxes being much smaller. We've seen the financialization of the economy occur where the financial sector then I think accounted for 23%, 20% of our total GDP, and now it's upward to 43%. I think Kelly, correct me if I'm wrong on those numbers, but we've just seen this dramatic shift. And what's happened is that people have kind of gotten left behind.
Yes.
You know, the economy has doubled in the last 30 years, but, you know, wages have stagnated. You know, it doesn't seem like we have, you know, people are now in debt more so than ever before as a student. But you just get the sense that, you know, there is money that's being made. We are still, you know, the richest nation on earth. But
yes.
That the American worker, the American middle class, seems to have less and less faith in the system. You know, faith in our institutions, faith in whether it's faith across institutions across the board. And so, you know, we have a society now that is quite different from before. And so that idea of the myth still persists.
Yes.
But when we look at the picture, and as Noam Chomsky lays out pretty clearly in our film, what that picture is, what these principles are that allow this vicious cycle to perpetuate. If we think about, you know, maybe there was a virtuous cycle before, where you had that middle class prosper and the economy grew and we prospered together.
Yes.
But now it seems to be the opposite. There's this vicious cycle. that's been put into motion.
All right.
And power begets wealth, and wealth begets power.
Exactly. And people are feeling left out, and we're not the United States. We're going to have to take a break right now, but we will be right back with my two guests. The film directors and producers, two of the three anyway, film directors and producers of Requiem for the American Dream. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Don't go away.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Once again, we enter the world of undocumented aliens. As with all illegals, they are brave, wandering souls vulnerable to transgression without recourse. Deportation is a dagger never far from their souls. Dirty Pretty Things is set in London. Nigerian-born Okwe, a medical doctor in his home country, is working the desk in a seedy hotel. When he finds a human heart stopping up a toilet, he knows something terrible is going on that he must somehow stop without betraying his own illegal status. For their own survival, many in this netherworld willingly sacrifice others, exploiting any weakness inside and outside the immigrant community. But Okwe finds an ally in Sine, an undocumented chambermaid. Together they work to solve the mystery of the heart. We root for Okwe and Sinai as they dodge danger, corruption, and connivance at every turn. They are determined to stop the victimization of vulnerable immigrants by a criminal operation swapping human organs for fake passports. Dirty Pretty Things is a dramatic thriller tightly directed by Stephen Frears. It offers an Oscar-nominated screenplay, world-class actors, a fascinating setting, and just maybe some satisfactory vengeance in the end. Indie Film Minute. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. We're talking to two of the three directors and producers of the Requiem for the American Dream, Kelly Nikes and Jarrett P. Scott. We've talked a bit about the politics, the financial realities, the pressures of student loans, economic opportunity, equality, and we're coming back to that. But for a bit, I want to talk to the two gentlemen with us today, Kelly and Jarrett, about the actual making of the documentary. Now, Jarrett, you mentioned that this was over a period of years. Kelly, how did you work that? Where did you shoot it, and how did you pull all that together?
Well, it's a great question, Marcello, and there are a number of points that I think are helpful to that are both specific to this film and then also more generally about independent documentary film.
Mm-hmm.
Jarrett and Peter and I have actually worked together on a number of different films, films that have covered American political and social issues from partisanship in American politics, and that but this film, obviously, the fraying of our social fabric and the unprecedented inequality that we see in America today. And what it was that was important to us is you know, you're going to spend a lot of time. That films are labors of love. We finance them ourselves, and so you have an incredible investment in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that investment, obviously, you would like the film to be as evergreen as possible.
You
would like it to be relevant to the conversation in society as long as possible. And so part of that in taking the time that we did to make this film was to make sure that this wasn't a reflection of a moment,
mm-hmm.
but actually a story of a nation.
Yes.
And to do so, we needed to make sure that we were taking the time, because we admired these films that have been made that really are able to articulate these long-enduring principles rather than being notes of a particular day. And I think so often of a film like Fog of War,
yes.
in which Errol Morris so thoughtfully was able to articulate these lessons from Robert McNamara and the
yes.
time that he had as a public servant. And in many ways, we see Requiem through the great fortune that we had of being able to sit down with Noam Chomsky over years and do multiple interviews and have these, obviously, he's one of the most influential intellectuals alive.
Yes, yes.
And have the opportunity to sit with him over the course of years and discuss in depth and dig down into this most important development of our time, the fact that we see America ostensibly the land of opportunity, now really divided into the exceptionally wealthy and the rest.
Yes.
And to have time to be able to do that and really look at that through, you know, a microscope and tease out what does this mean in terms of, as you were referencing, our policy and our understandings and our sense of solidarity around education.
Yes.
What does it mean in terms of what's the correlation between union memberships and our ability to organize and have a voice in collective bargaining?
Yes.
What does it mean in terms of the relationship of the private sector and the public sector, and the private gain at the expense of public pain?
Mm-hmm. You know,
what are those different relationships? You're always going to have tensions in that. And again, it's like the core of what made this film such an intellectual challenge, what made it so exciting, and what made it such a privilege to be able to tell this story was the fact that we were able to do so with, you know, one of the greatest thinkers of our time.
Yes.
And be able to bring that story hopefully to as wide an audience as possible so that we could have meaningful conversations about these issues.
So we are beautifully segued back into what is at the core of this film, and that is the, I say again, forgive the cliche, the cold water in our face, because I think the public has been numbed by, well, you know, when you wake up in the morning and your first thought out of necessity is survival and not seeing a lot of hope that you can finance your survival, that you're just the conduit of the not enough money coming in and too much going out. It needs this kind of film and the kind of intellectual approach and explanation. We need to understand, as we have been, the three of us have been talking here, that this is not something, you know, people say, where's America's spring? Well, it's been such a slow boiling of the water for the frog that I think we gave up, we just gave up trying or thinking that we could succeed. Again, that image that Jared has given us of the towering building on Park Avenue, where the super rich can quite literally look down on the, as John Boehner once said, the ants. I wonder, Jared, how, talk to us, because I think you started this and we never quite went there. The 10 principles of concentration of wealth and power. What are some of those principles, and how, what are we supposed to be learning about them from your film?
Sure. Yeah. And you mentioned, like, during the second half, that you wanted to talk more about filmmaking.
Yes.
Perspective. And you're right. I mean, these principles, now these are not Professor Chomsky's principles.
Yes.
Here are these 10 principles that we want to lay out. But what we did is, you know, after all these interviews, after listening to a number of things that Professor Chomsky kept reiterating, kept saying every time we went back to him,
yes,
it became pretty clear that he was circling around the same issues time and time again. And so, you know, we were able to then, you know, because one of our biggest goals in making this film was to bring Noam Chomsky to an audience that hadn't experienced him before.
Yes.
And create a really digestible experience. I mean, our job as filmmakers is often to sit down with people, and you look at hours and hours and hours of footage, and it's all terrific, and it's all fascinating, but then you need to put it into a digestible format.
Yes.
You need to organize the ideas in a way that allows the viewer to have a cumulative experience, to have a journey as they go through the film.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that, we were able to, over much deliberation and countless hours with a script in front of us, the transcripts, and sitting in front of the editing stations, we were able to finally kind of pinpoint these 10 principles. And Professor Chomsky elucidates on these, and so I'll try to keep them brief, and I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, it's these principles that are in plain sight that we sometimes don't think about. You know, it's that idea of when Professor Chomsky has this encyclopedia kind of
mind,
you know, wealth,
yes,
of mind.
Yes.
And so, but he's also very approachable. And if you do listen and you're able to focus on certain things, he's able to paint these in a way that's astonishingly clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so he breaks down the facts and the stakes that, we can just keep for what they are. Engineering elections. Reduce democracy.
Yes.
Keeping the rabble in line. Shaping ideology. A number of these things. That he's able just to walk through. And of course, they all overlap and they're all connected.
Sure.
But it's that vicious cycle that he calls it. And so we talk about all these because the idea, the vicious cycle, is pretty easy for us all to grasp.
Yes.
This idea that wealth begets power and power begets wealth, so on and so forth. But that these are the instruments, these are the tools, these are some of the principles that the rich and powerful abide by to continue that process.
I wonder, it seems, and I don't mean it to be rhetorical or naive, but I keep finding as I write about such things, I wonder what the super powerful, or financially powerful, have lost a sense of everything needs a foundation. And if all of the wealth, or all of the anything, is top-heavy, without the foundation of a solid, in this case, middle class, manufacturing infrastructure, all of that. If that foundation is not solid under you, then how long can we be so top heavy and think everything is fine? I mean, I know my Uncle Gino used to say, just because they got the money don't care, means they got the smarts. I get that. I hear him every day in my mind still.
That's an uncanny impression of your uncle,
I think. Yes. Well, it's just, he used to say that to me, I mean, when I was a kid. So I've heard it much of my life. And finally, I believe, as I see what's happening, as you say, in the last, since World War II, I think we all agree things have been growing in this direction. But in the last 30 years in particular, and the last 20, and in this century, I don't understand, and again, I'm not being rhetorical or naive, I'd like to hear from you, what do they think is going to happen when the people they need, it so galls me, to hear people say, we built that whole crowd, but no, you didn't. You might have thought of it, and that's great. You might have designed it. You might have planned it. You might have goals set for it, but you hired people who were able to carry out that dream, that vision, and they are as much a part of the building as you are. What do you think, Kelly? What are they? Do they think this is just endless? You just get more and more houses and swimming pools and cash, and you put it all in a foreign country or somewhere, and then when America fails, you fly to Mars? I mean, what's the story?
Well, what I think is I'd like actually to take a step back and look at it through a slightly different lens and address the question you asked previously. How do you get up in the morning with every and look at the day with any sense of hope and expectation when every day is a battle for survival?
Yes.
And this, to me, comes back to what you had initially mentioned about that it's nice to hear that this film does have a sense of hope in it.
Yes, yes.
That one so often associates Chomsky with this very dour, in certain circles and anti-American view of our country and our people and the way it is that we organize ourselves. But I think that what's important is that very question, how do you wake up every morning and face that day when it seems like there are no prospects, when it seems like there's no hope? And I think that if we say that hope is the belief in the possibility to change your circumstance, then we could probably agree that that's a pretty usable definition of hope. That we have the possibility to change our circumstances. Now, in this day and age, it's very difficult to see where it is that we might be able to affect that change, or we might be able to buy that change. And we're very, as we know through study and scholarship, we're very fractured.
Yes.
Robert Putnam wrote about this very thoughtfully in Bowling Alone. We see that voter participation, we lag far behind other countries.
Yes.
Somewhere in the mid-60s, traditionally, regardless of who's running for president, whether it's Barack Obama or whether it's George W. Bush, two admittedly very different politicians, but still we see generally the same kind of turnout. There might be a percentage more here or there, but generally we have a low voter participation because we're separated from each other. And you hear that all the time, even just in normal conversation, people saying, well, God, I mean, everybody seems to be online all the time, and now we have these devices that constantly demand our attention. But I think that what's so valuable about this film and why this this holistic perspective that Chomsky brings to the conversation, brings to this very important subject of where it is that we are, is that if we can't see where it is that we can achieve victories, what's amazing about putting ourselves in this historical context is that we can take such inspiration and we can take such fortitude from the victories of those who came before us.
Yes.
We have at our hands so many tools at our disposal to be able to make those changes that we would like to see happen. And we're looking at people who were legally disenfranchised, when you're looking at segregation, legally not allowed to voice their concerns and to bring grievances to government. We now have a legally even playing field that may not be how it is in practice, and we should absolutely make sure that that is addressed, and we should invest our energy to make sure that the spirit of the law and the letter of the law match its articulation in the social landscape. But I think that we should very much benefit from the fact that we can look to these predecessors, to these generations that came before us, and find incredible inspiration and solace in the fact that they were able to bear better circumstances against difficult conflicts, and that we have, therefore, if we can't imagine, if we can't see, envision our own possibilities, that we can inspire by those that have been won in the victories that have been won in the past.
You know, and that's true. And there was, and I do think, and I'm not against 21st century devices. I'm not an absolute expert on them, but I learn and I welcome change and I love learning new things. But there is an absence, as I've just written this past week on Op-Ed News, there is an absence of that coffee house enlightenment. A coffee house sitting down, whether it's a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, whatever your preference, but an exchange of ideas that's not just about convincing the other person that they're stupid or wrong, but is about learning new things, new information. I think I sit and I listen to people when I have these little coffee meetings that I give occasionally, and there are a lot of things said about a lot of the hot issues of the day, and I don't agree with them, but it's fascinating to listen. And when I hear their perspective, it affects my thinking and my drive home and what I write. And I'm wondering, Jared, I mean, there's just so much. We don't have time to cover everything, but and there is hope in Professor Chomsky. I know I mentioned, I think, off air, when I've listened to books that he's written, and it is easier for me to listen because I travel a lot, but it's also easier because I can stop the CD and think as I drive and then go back to him and see, okay, I think I know where he is, because he does have an amazing mind. But what about super PACs and Citizens United, and how do we get the American people to be heard by the judicial system, which is supposed to be separate from us in the sense of its objectivity? I know a lot of judges, of course, are elected, but in the case of the Supreme Court, we want them to be objective. We don't want them to be ruled by the mob. But, you know, there are different kinds of mobs. What do you think, Jared?
Well, I could go into a full diatribe about mobs, but I won't. No, I'm kidding. But no, you bring up Citizens United again. I mean, it's there is a section in the film that's called Engineering Elections.
Yes.
And we get into that. We talk about its roots and going back to the 19th Amendment, going back to Buckley versus Ballio. So we get into that, and you know, I think that when we go through all these principles, it's the same story that that our voice is diminished. And you know, with this wealth that begets power, political power, you know, particularly so because, as you mentioned, the cost of elections have skyrocketed.
Yes.
Whether it's through this absolute flood of campaign of money that we need to run these campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
You and I both know that the majority that I was just down actually in D.C. last week, I always joke with the security guards when you're entering into the different buildings in Congress, and you're like, oh, are they in session today? And they're like, God, you know, yeah, they are, but you know, it's like they're never here, and you know, they're like, we're here, you know, day in, day out, and these guys come in, they kind of, you know, they're kind of here 70 days, you know, of most of that time, they're, you know, they're not legislating. They're dialing for dollars.
Yes.
They're fundraising. So, you know, you can even hear it with the people that are working in the halls of Congress. So, you know, so yeah, then who is it that, whose voice is it that's getting heard? Mm. And we don't set out to vilify the aristocracy. We don't point out the Koch brothers.
Yes.
Or go through a number of people. We just talk about these principles.
Yes.
And we talk about the fact that this is the way that the system's set up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was definitely orchestrated this way through a business offensive, through a financial aristocracy. There were mechanisms at play here. But at the end of the day, you know, this is supposed to be, in words, this is supposed to be a democracy.
Yeah.
And in a democracy, we're supposed to have that voice.
Yes.
And so I think that, you know, from a filmmaking perspective, to bring it back to that, I think our job is to try to just, you know, knowledge is power, right?
Yes.
And film's such a low entrance barrier. So what we want to do is we want to come to this film, be informed, be inspired, raise awareness, and then spread that message. And I think if you can understand in a digestible way from a brilliant man in one of his final interviews of this kind,
yes,
then, you know, that's the thing that you mentioned that kind of empowers you and makes you think on that drive home.
Yes.
And that's what we want, because it starts there. And then maybe you will get more involved in you know, how your community delegates certain funds or your local politics. Maybe you will join a group that's trying to go for a constitutional amendment, you know, move to amend or root strikers, whomever
yes.
it is. You keep bringing up the Citizens United. So, you know, we do need to get involved, and not to sound after school about it, but there is this apathy. There is this complacency. And
yes.
so we are all at fault. Now, granted, there are forces and powers that be.
Yes.
No doubt about it. Very strong forces at play. But we as a people do need to at some point also accept our responsibility.
Exactly.
To create the democracy that we want. And Chomsky clearly lays, you know, he discusses this. He's like, hey, look, and he quotes his good friend, the late Howard Zinn, saying that, you know, it's always been the small action, a number of small actions by a group of unknown people
yes.
that have paved the way for these victories before, and will do it again. And so I think that's ultimately the message and the takeaway that we want to have people walk out of the theater with, that they do feel, that they do understand how daunting and how serious the problem is.
Yes.
But also that power ultimately, as Chomsky quotes Hume, power is in the hands of the government.
Yes, exactly, and it still is in the hands of the government, as I think Kelly was saying. We do bear the responsibility of voting, and not thinking the vote doesn't count, because it does. And as I said before, I've been a member of grassroots lobbyists who've gone to the Hill and actually met with members of Congress in both houses, Senator Kaine once, and I've been asked by organizations to be a lobbyist for the Alzheimer's Association with our Virginia legislators. But what I love, as a person who's worked on camera, and what I love is that film is a powerful medium. As we get a large number of people to sit in the dark and watch and let it wash over them, both individually and as a community. And then when it is done at its best, it gets them to think. I just think you've done a great thing here in listening to our conversation about your work, A Requiem for the American Dream, a feature documentary.
Can I actually address that point that you just
sure.
raised?
Sure, sure, sure.
One of the things that we're excited about being in New York is the fact that the very point that you're addressing
uh-huh.
about film being an opportunity for us to get together as
yes.
a community,
yes,
for us to get together, sit in that room, share that cinematic experience, and then with documentaries that unpack social and cultural issues, have a conversation, see your neighbor face to face, not from behind
yes.
a computer screen or over a mobile device, but actually get in the room together and have a dialogue about issues that are of common concern. And Jared and I have been very fortunate to be at the forefront in a number of instances where film has had real material change. If you'll remember the People's Climate March
yes.
on September 21st of last year was the largest climate change demonstration in history, and we were very fortunate to be commissioned to make the film Disruption, which was the primary mobile tool for that film. So we very much believe in the power of film to influence behaviors and attitudes and affect how it is that people understand and see certain issues, and the sense of shared responsibility and solidarity with people within a community, and that we have the power to address issues of common concern. And so I think that, film, particularly in this day and age, as people migrate towards visual forms of communication and learning, I think that this is a great opportunity for us to be able to dive in as a community. Because this really is only going to be solved as a community. This is not going to be solved by one person or another. This is going to be solved by a community coming together to address these issues that affect us all. And I think that we believe to do that in film, other people do that in writing or in music or in different forms of expression. Some people do it by legislating, by running for office. We have chosen the medium because that's what it is that we feel called to do, a film. And we feel very fortunate to have the opportunity to sit down with someone as informed and as influential in thinking as Noam Chomsky. But ultimately, film is a tool that we now see as having incredible potential to affect change in our communities. And I think that you're right on saying, like, this is an opportunity to once again come together and be able to have that shared experience and then have that communal dialogue that's so crucial to addressing these problems that we see today.
Absolutely. All right, gentlemen, I hate to go. I hope our paths will cross again. I hope we get to work together. The feature-length documentary premiering at the 2015 Tribeca Film Festival in New York City, of course, Requiem for the American Dream. We have been speaking to Kelly Nikes and Jared P. Scott, and our hat off to also their co-director and producer, Peter Hutchinson. And it has been my pleasure. Tell us, gentlemen, how do we give us a Facebook page or how we can follow the film?
Sure, yeah. You can go to Requiem for the American Dream on Facebook. We've also been fortunate enough to work with the very generous and committed people behind Chomsky's fan page, so hopefully we'll have news come out that way.
Yes.
But yeah, there's four screenings at place during Tribeca. So if you're an American Express card holder, you can purchase those in advance on March 31st. If you live in Tribeca or in downtown Manhattan, you can then purchase those by April 5th, and then they're open to the general public on April 6th. So I'd say get them while they're hot.
That's right.
Because they'll probably go fast. There's four screenings, like I said. The first screening is on the 18th. The last screening is on the 25th. So there's plenty of great times. They're all times that don't overlap with the average work day. So that's great. They're either at night or on the weekend.
Yes.
So we have great slots, and there's a great opportunity for you to come see Noam Chomsky on the big screen.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, gentlemen, and I appreciate you being on the show, and I wish you and your film all the very best. And America, too, for that matter.
Thanks so much, Marcella.
Thank you. Bye now.
Stay with us, as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Indie film distribution today doesn't leave a ton of room for experimentation, but once in a while, a film comes along that is so strange yet so grippingly interesting, you can't help but keep watching just to see what happens. Andrew Bachowski's Computer Chess is one of those rare films. Set in 1980 and shot on old-fashioned black-and-white video to recreate what amateur footage from the era would look like, the film follows an ensemble of characters at a computer chess tournament. The film's weaving storylines involve a young nerd's questioning of his mentors and subsequent sexual awakening, a hotshot programmer's fall from grace, a chess grandmaster running the tournament who seems perpetually surprised to see a female programmer at the proceedings, and rumors about the tournament and the brilliant minds who designed the chess software being watched by the Pentagon, trying to glean candidates for their next project. It's hard to pin down what makes computer chess so fascinating. It is humorous, hypnotic, and unconventional, an example of the kind of film never found in the multiplex. But with luck in your pocket, a gem uncovered at a film fest, or through the Indie Film Minute that leaves your film horizons expanded. Computer Chess. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Find us on the web at IndieFilmMinute.com.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. The elephant in the coffee shop. There is no innocence in electing those who pretend to be ignorant to win votes from those herded into non-thinking gerrymandered districts, and no stupidity in the politicians reaping the reward. Except perhaps Downton Abbey Representative Aaron Schock. But we have bigger elephants than temper tantrum John McCain daring to lecture President Obama on temper in the room. Relegating African-American history to February and herstory of women to March encourages short-term memory loss regarding both for 10 months a year and diminishes the whole of America's identity. Not binding our hard copy history with the history of African Americans and women creates a vacuum in our electoral process and disconnects non-whites from the non-thinking elephants in the back rooms of corporatism, police units, campuses, Congress, and, of course, town hall meetings. It is not our bankruptcy in math and science education that is impoverishing our national intellect. It is the inherited closed minds we continue to allow to define what education is and what it is not. Citizens United on Facebook against Supreme Justices Scalia, Alito, and Roberts, ignoring the reality of America's 21st century racism while gutting our 1965 Voting Rights Act, is deficient patriotism. When social media isn't enough, and it isn't, we need to educate ourselves with the art of coffeehouse enlightenment. While ignored by Supremes and seemingly just discovered by our media, all life matters. Racism did not end in 1865 nor 1968. Without ERA ratification, women are not constitutionally equal. Without gender, racial, and sexual equality, there is no equal economic opportunity. Student loans and the Great Recession sacrifice our future on the altar of the top 1%. Oil industry, like Shell in Norco, Louisiana, make money by endangering lives and the environment. Perpetual war costs could put solar panels on every American home. Fraternities are time capsules of boys where women have neither vote nor voice. There are many honorable, uniformed, law-abiding citizens, but too many uniforms are shielding racists and rapists from due process. And finally, Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz, and Rick Scott are not the only reality deniers elected by reality deniers. Education is learning to reason, to think for ourselves. Historically, after conversing with creative thinkers, we'd emerge wiser. It's not just that geniuses like Benjamin Franklin enjoy coffee chats with other geniuses like Ernest Hemingway, but that all broaden their education when taking time to stimulate the brain through personal engagement with thinking people. Diversity of thought through conversation inspires acumen. Unlike regurgitating dates and formulas, teaching to the test, absorbing whitewashed versions of American history, pigeonholed in overcrowded classrooms, or thinking outside the box deprived. Prioritizing mental health and family, 49ers Chris Borland's end run for brain safety is a touchdown for higher education. Following the examples of those who know enough to seize the benefits of differing points of view proves two heads are better than one, if both heads are thinking before speaking. Total agreement is not the goal, merely one sip of coffee or tea possibility as we think out loud for the joy of discovery. To mastermind equality, we need to master the art of face-to-face civil discourse. Meanwhile, tasers, nightsticks, guns, white hoods, burning crosses, and hanging trees are as prescient in cyberbullying, cowardly trolling Twitter, conservative jurists gaveling on the backs of human trafficking, as Virginia's ABC state of agents bloodying a UVA honor student while declaring we're living in a post-racial America. The elephant in the room? With the repetitive breaking news of police brutality on black Americans, sleeping nudes posted on Facebook by frat boys after they've date-drugged them, and LGBT denied the rights of a full American citizenship, perhaps after all, we are settling for being a third-world oasis in a first-world region. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.